to the Creative Weirdos Podcast. I hope all has been going well for you all this holiday season. I am very excited to share today's episode with you. It is the second installment in the Comic Book Weirdness series, and it's with somebody that I've wanted to talk to for a very long time and inspired a lot of the thoughts that you hear me talk about on this podcast, and I bring up a lot, and maybe in every interview, almost every interview, and that is Dr. Jeffrey Kripal. Jeff holds the J. Newton Razor Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University and has written some of the most inspiring books on the topics of science fiction, comic books, and paranormal ideas, and a bunch of other topics that really mean a lot to me. Today we sit down and talk about his book, Mutants and Mystics, that he wrote back in 2011, that's about science fiction, superhero comics, and the paranormal. You've heard me talk about this book a lot. It's been one of my favorites that I've read for a long time now, and we get into a lot of ideas that surround the real weirdness that can come from comics and how important and undervalued the imagination and fiction is. We touch on some of my favorite weird stories that surround comics, such as those of Barry Windsor Smith and Grant Morrison, both in which Jeff has written and taught thoroughly about. So just a wonderful person to bounce these ideas off of. I think y'all are really going to enjoy this one. And we have plenty more of this comics coverage coming soon, especially on the Stranger side. I'm really excited to talk to a few of the first professional comic artists I've talked to on here, and a bunch of other people that I think have some really valuable and weird insights into this sequential art form. So without further ado, let's get to the episode. Enjoy, and go support and check out Jeff's work, all linked below. I'll be back next week with another episode, and until then, take care. Talk to you soon. Bye.
I prefer Jeff. I mean, that's my name. When I was a kid, I used to mow. I used to mow for a living. There was an elderly woman who insisted on calling me Jeffrey. She says, "Now that's your real name. This Jeff stuff, that's just a nickname." She absolutely refused. But you know, I just go by Jeff. And
I like it. Were you cutting grass to buy comic books at that point?
No, I was just cutting grass. I was just mowing. I don't even know why I was doing it. It was just something I did as a kid. I mowed people's lawns, and you know, I can't say I made a living, because of course I didn't, but I made some money.
I have a few friends that just love cutting grass. Like they don't like gardening. They don't like any of the, they just love cutting grass. And I'm like, more power to you. That's awesome. That's their little meditative practice. And I think it's a beautiful one. So I'm really excited to talk to you today about a bunch of different stuff. We can kind of let this go wherever, but I asked you on because I'm doing a little series of the podcast that has to do with comics and fiction and weirdness that surrounds the creators and the fictional experience in general. And your book Mutants and Mystics was one of the first points that, like, I think really solidified a lot of these ideas and shared stories I had never heard of before. And some of those I'd love to kind of talk to you about. But before we go down into any specifics here, can you just give an overview of the work Mutants and Mystics and kind of what your goal was for writing the book?
Yeah. So, I mean, to talk about that book, I also need to talk about another book called Authors of the Impossible, which is really where the theory is or where the ideas are for the Mutants and Mystics book. And I don't mean to sell you another book, Todd, but what actually happened was I wrote a book in 2007 called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion. It was essentially on the counterculture and on the human potential movement, which came out of California. And I found myself it's a big book. It's a big, thick book. And you know, around 06, 05, maybe, I was just getting obsessed with the X-Men. And I was like, why am I? First of all, the X-Men were not particularly popular when I was a kid. They were like a B-level or C-level kind of comic. I mean, nobody, I mean, it was so bad that they were doing reruns and just putting new covers on them. I mean, it was really, nobody read it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they rebooted it in 75 and it became a kind of sensation. But the question for me in 05 was, why am I so obsessed with this comic book from when I was a kid, basically? And I realized that, oh, the central idea of the human potential movement is that there are these abilities or these capacities that are somehow given to us by evolution and that they're increasing. And I realized, oh my God, this is the X-Men mythology, only this is not fiction in this case. In California, it's as if California took up what was fantasy created in the East Coast in New York, and they turned it into a series of spiritual or alternative religious movements. And so I just became fascinated with how the fiction on the East Coast was replicating or mirroring what was going on the West Coast. And so I decided to write about that. I decided to write about basically comic books and science fiction. I decided to write about my youth, essentially. It was what I call my midlife regression book. And so I started out thinking about this question of creativity and writing. And I wrote Authors of the Impossible as I thought I was writing Mutants and Mystics. I really did. I thought I was just writing the introduction and maybe chapter one, and it turned into this whole book and this whole theory. And then I wrote Mutants and Mystics after it. But the basic idea is that paranormal events are inevitably stories. And they happen to people because of particular plot lines and because of a kind of creativity that's, I think, largely unconscious. Well, I think it's entirely unconscious, actually. And by unconscious, I mean it's not in the control of the person. Things are just happen to the person. And if you talk to somebody who's had a paranormal experience, they'll say things like, it was as if I was in a movie, or it was as if I were a character in a novel, you know, to which I always respond, well, you are. Inside a story right now, and you're telling one, and culture itself is a narrative and a set of assumptions and a plot line, and so is religion. I mean, my job is to understand religion, and religion is basically about big stories that people take to be true. And so I began to realize that, and I was sitting with a lot of scientists, Todd. I had spent months and months at Esalen sitting with physicists and geneticists and neuroscientists trying to study the paranormal. And they were always looking for a mechanism, and they were always looking for some kind of material reason. And I was like, well, what if there is no mechanism? I mean, what if this is a story? What if these people are caught in a story? And they just looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yes, and,
but I was serious. I was like, no, really, I don't think there's a mechanism. I think something's telling a story here, and these people are realizing it. And so I started to develop this idea that really what was being called for was for us to wake up inside this story and maybe tell a different story, you know? And I was working with a lot of young people, and I realized that most people don't actually like the stories they're born into. They don't work so well. And particularly with religion, a lot of religions were created hundreds or thousands of years ago with social and moral values that are just completely rejected now. And people are kind of caught in these stories, and they suffer. They suffer intensely. And I felt like, okay, well, what we're really being called to do is tell a different story. And so I turned to fiction and comics, because I thought, oh, these are super creative people. Maybe they can tell us something. And what I found was that some of the most creative people in those worlds are precisely the people who have had paranormal experiences.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that is so interesting. And I began to suspect that paranormality and creativity were deeply connected. They were not separate. These were not. Well, what interested me about the authors and the artists was they were not like the scientists. They did not try to prove that A, B, or C happened. They just turned it into another comic book.
Absolutely.
Or another novel. And I was like, oh my God, they're like doing art. They're like creating art out of this. And this isn't about proof. This is about art and life and living in another story. And I got to know actually some of the artists and authors that I grew up with as a kid. I mean, I adored these people. And it turned out as an adult, they would actually talk to me. And that was a revelation, by the way. And I read that, you know, I read their journals and read some of their books, and I'm like, oh, okay. And so I wrote Mutants and Mystics. And the basic argument of that book is that the superpowers are real, and that people actually do have these abilities and these powers, but that what these artists and authors are doing is they're taking this real world capacity and they're exaggerating it, and they're putting spandex on people and blowing stuff up, basically. But that there's a kind of core to these stories that is actually the case, and that this is what creates the attraction, I think, for people. This is why these stories become so central to culture and make so much money in the movies and television, that there's a core there. And yes, people recognize it. People are like, oh, you know, maybe not consciously, Todd. I'm not saying that we're sitting around recognizing ourselves on Netflix or in the movies, but we kind of are.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, and I also realized that, you know, you can't talk about these things in politics. You can't be a politician and talk about your UFO sighting. You also can't talk about your precognitive dream in a church or a synagogue or a temple. And I realized, but you can turn these things into art and do it in entertainment as a video game or a television series or something you watch, you know. I was like, oh, okay, that's what our culture is going to allow, but they're not going to allow it to be taken too seriously in these other modes. And so I wrote the book, you know, kind of thinking, okay, well, what is this story that all of this fiction and all of this science fiction and all of these, what is the bigger story that they're telling? And so I organized the book around what I call these myth themes and tried to lay out what I think the bigger story is.
Yeah, no, that was... There's so much there, Jeff, that I want to go down. And that was a beautiful summary of what the book is. And I think, well, one, to start with, this whole podcast is an exploration of exactly what you said. And it's why I love some of your work. But that connection between creativity and the paranormal and strangeness. Yeah. I have two groups of friends primarily, and it's artists and people in the realm of the weird and paranormal. And what I noticed really quickly is that all the artists that I talk to, all my friends that make stuff, they will really quickly get to the fact that they are not responsible for their ideas or the stuff that hits really good and makes them successful. They have no clue why it worked or how it connected or where it came from. And once they really start talking, they start talking about how much they love to either listen to paranormal podcasts while they're drawing, or like, it's all in there. And then when I talk to my friends in the paranormal world, they're all authors or podcasters or artists. And then you start seeing how experiencers become artists after these experiences they have sometimes, and there's this really strong connection to creativity. And then I find a book like yours who lays out these beautiful experiences that people like Barry Windsor Smith had that I'd never heard about before. That's one of my favorites in the book, right? And yeah, things like you go really deep into Grant Morrison's experiences and his ideas, which you just remind me of several of them that are my favorite. And one of them that I've been wanting to ask you about is, it's a small comic he did that was right after Flex Mentallo, and it's not quite as popular, but essentially it proposed the idea that superheroes and all of these characters were real in the 3D reality at one point, and they were putting out these very day-to-day minor kind of golden age comic problems, right? Like, really stop the bank robber, Superman can't fly yet, he can just bound from building to building, kind of tied to reality. But then they realize that that's not going to work with the next generation of threats, and the only way to scale up their defense of this world or America or whatever you want to call it at that time was to insert themselves into a mythology and to become fiction and try and change people's hearts and minds via stories instead of putting out the fires. And I love that idea, and I think it's such a fun one to play with. And what you were saying at the end there, that fiction is the place where we allow these ideas, it reminds me of that like these ideas and the paranormal and the weird might want to function in those arenas because it's where they like to be in this fictional world, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, so I come from the study of religion, Todd. I mean, I always have religion somewhere in the back of my mind. And by religion, I don't mean the religion somebody likely grew up with and did awful things to them. I mean the history of religions where these sorts of experiences and powers are talked about endlessly. And so when I read comics as a kid, or even certainly as an adult, I mean, there's a long background to this stuff. You know, this was not invented in 1938 or 1961. I mean, this goes back thousands of years, and we've been writing comic books for a long time, Todd. I mean, for millennia. Yeah. But here's the difference. You know, one of my jokes is that religion is art that doesn't know it's art.
Oh, wow.
I don't mean it's just art. You know, that's where people, I think, mishear me. They think, oh, he's making a reductive argument that it's just fantasy, it's just hallucination. I'm like, no, it's not. There's something about religion historically that has given people this ability to imagine themselves in other circumstances and as other than human. And I think that's very powerful. And I think today, you know, we've sort of abandoned our religious background, or a lot of us have, but we turn to things like science fiction and comics and things to sort of regain these other abilities. And it's not that the religions of the past have the answer. I'm not saying that, Todd. I'm not glorifying the past, but I'm also not glorifying the present.
That's very fair. That's very fair. And yeah. That aligns with, I mean, it's funny because every piece of comics history or anything that you look into, it wants to start with the first comic was the cave painting. And I always, like, it's one of those things that I kind of like shudder at and love at the same time, because to go back to Morrison, he talks about it in the way that the cave paintings weren't, you know, done to celebrate the hunt. They were done to fulfill the hunt. It was like a magical ritual. Like, they were essentially doing the artwork in which to perform the task at hand, and those type of things, which I think there's just so much there to those ideas of playing with reality via art. And I really love how, one, the comics allows for these people that are essentially straight-laced folks that are kind of squares to have these like really cosmic, like psychedelic experiences. Like, when you talk about Steve Ditko or Jack Kirby, they are on record saying, like, I am the squarest person in comics. I do not do psychedelics. I'm offended that you think I do. But then you look at their work and it's, you know, it's there. It's they're tapping into what Jack referred to as the source. And when he gets into his fourth world stuff, he's obviously having religious experiences at the drawing table. And I think there's something to the immense imaginal workload that the comics force you to do. When you're a Jack Kirby turning out 6 pages a day, like, you're not really thinking about this stuff cognitively. It's just coming to you and it's flowing through you. And I love Barry Windsor Smith was the example I wanted to kind of ask you about, because I don't hear it talked about very often, but it's the same thing. He's working in a field. I mean, This is one of my other favorite parts about comics is that it's kind of like garbage culture that came out of a like industry that hated it. All the artists hated being a part of it. Like, I'm from Wilmington, Delaware. We're in the Brandywine Valley, which is the golden age of illustration. Like in the 1900s, culture was defined by Howard Pyle and these beautiful illustrators that were from this area. And I grew up on N.C. Wyeth and all J.C. Leyendecker and all these beautiful American illustrators that were the movie stars at the time. They were defining fashion. They were defining everything else because all you had was magazines and newspapers, right? And then I remember when I was young, they did this exhibit on how it was the end of the illustration era because photography came, right? And photography said, we're slashing all the budgets for the magazines. We don't need to pay thousands of dollars for these lush, beautiful paintings anymore because people like the pictures better and they're cheaper. But that created this whole other industry, which was comics and sequential art and animation. All this creative power had to go somewhere, all of these ideas, and it popped out in things like comics. So I think there's something beautiful to a medium that was kind of born out of shit, if that makes sense. And but Barry Windsor Smith is working at these immense deadlines, probably not getting paid, but he should get paid. He's giving his artwork to somebody that he's never going to get his artwork back. This is like beautiful pieces of American history that, well, like I said, that point he was drawing in England, right? He wasn't drawing in America yet. But regardless, he's working in a medium that doesn't respect the art, but he's spending hours and hours at the drawing table, and he has these cosmic experiences that I'd love to hear you expand on if you'd be into it.
Yeah, so Barry Windsor Smith was one of my heroes that I was talking about as a kid. I mean, he, you know, in the 19, I was born in 62, so I was reading comics in the early 70s, and Barry Windsor Smith was sort of the cutting edge, one of the cutting edge artists. You know, Kirby was active and Ditko, and there were all these other people doing things, but Barry Windsor Smith was in charge of this comic called Conan the Barbarian that Marvel was doing. And he was a trained artist. He was, he had sort of this Renaissance style, and he made Conan basically cool. I mean, you know, Conan wasn't that cool, by the way. I mean, but Barry Windsor Smith made him really cool. And what is astonishing. So I grew up, you know, reading Barry Windsor Smith. He did the early run of Conan probably through 20 or 21. I don't know how long he went. But then in the 90s, he published these memoirs called Opus, and it turns out that he was having these cosmic experiences of precognition and different altered states while he was drawing comics. And that shocked me, you know, as a young man, as a young intellectual. And by the way, I ran into these in the home of Jacques Vallée, the UFO researcher, and Jacques handed me, he literally handed me the books of Barry Windsor Smith, who had sent them to him. And he said, look, I think you might be really, I was like, yeah, I'm like really interested in this.
That part made me so happy reading that. Like those two names being mentioned, like that was just beautiful. Like I love that.
Well, so Barry Windsor Smith was clearly corresponding with Jacques and for a reason. And so I went down that rabbit hole and I read the two volumes of Opus and I corresponded with Barry Windsor Smith. And I that was a case in that book that was very dear to my own heart because it was so close to my upbringing. And the other thing to say there that I think, you know, it's kind of funny. It's not definitely not Barry Windsor Smith, but the comics were, a kind of trash literature. It was kind of inappropriate, you know.
Jack Kirby used to say, if you wanted to be a respectable person, you would read the pulp, or you would read the novels and the Saturday Evening Post. But if you're the kind of guy that hung out at pool halls, you read comics.
Well, we literally bought comics where our dad bought pornography.
Yes.
I mean, well, they were literally in the drugstore, And, you know, I was reading these as a kid and I was like, why am I so excited? You know, and of course I was excited because it was basically a bunch of naked bodies with clothes on, but I mean, all these arching, stretching bodies. And I was like 8 or 9. I don't know how old I was.
And there's such a beautiful hidden history of pornography and comics that could be a whole book. I feel like the publisher of Opus was Fantagraphics in America in the early 90s. Fantagraphics was existing on Eros, which was its adult comic line at that point. It was the only thing paying the bills.
Like, see, you're telling me that, but I don't. Sense to me, by the way.
Yeah, they were all, they're about to go bankrupt. The only thing keeping the doors open was because that was that whole flux in the 90s of the speculator boom and all of that stuff with the Image Comics. And very interesting history there. But yeah, I've always been fascinated with the connection of essentially like adult, pornography, pulp, this whole kind of, I've heard other people, the Weird Studies guys, who are some of my favorite podcasters and thinkers, they use this term garbage culture that I really love. And they use it in an endearing, like very, I don't know if it's their term. They may have taken it from somebody else. But I like that. Like, I like that. It's kind of what America's good at in a way.
Well, you know, so all my early work was on the interface between sexuality and religious experience. And I mean the really extreme stuff. I'm not talking about feeling pious, you know, in a church. I'm like leaving your body and becoming one with the universe. And this has had a profoundly sexual element to it that I called the erotic. And so when I was thinking about the eroticism of the comics, I mean, it made a lot of sense to me. It was like, okay, this is another example of that. But it, of course, isn't culturally affirmed. Mm-hmm. It isn't. And what makes me laugh is these are basically men in New York making money off of like weird adolescent kids like myself in Nebraska. And you know, the other thing was you went to the back of the comic book and there were all of these super inappropriate ads, you know? And I ordered everything, Todd. I wanted to learn the death touch and the martial arts and the whole thing. I was totally into all of it. And I remember one of my funniest memories is I wanted to order these Chinese throwing stars. Mm-hmm. And I did. And they came in the mail and you could throw these things that they would stick in a wall or they would stick in a tree. And it's like, you know, as an adult, as a dad, I'm like, what guy was in the basement punching out deadly throwing stars for a 10-year-old? This is not right. You know,
there was no
law. It was like the wild, wild west of things.
And,
it was actually great. And I didn't end up harming anybody, but I could have. I could have definitely
totally
seriously injured myself or somebody else.
There was a magic to that wild westness of the comics industry, though, because they've literally, like, when you, Kirby is my favorite example of this because he lived every bit of the comics history. Like, he started when comic books weren't a thing. He started in comic strips when he was there the first time. They're like, oh, we can put these things in books and sell them at newsstands. And then he invented whole genres. And I love this transition that him and his whole generation of artists went through by going to war and coming back. And when you look at Kirby's work before the war and after the war, same thing with another one of my favorite comic artists, Will Eisner. If you look, he did a comic strip called The Spirit. And if you look at The Spirit before the war and after the war, completely different everything, like from subject matter to composition. Like, these guys not only leveled up in certain ways artistically, but they were obviously processing trauma through this work that they were coming back
course.
And putting out.
Absolutely.
And what a place to process it when your audience is 7 to 14-year-olds. You know what I mean? Like,
well, and the thing I learned about Kirby, you know, I did a lot of reading and talking for that book, and Kirby was just obsessed with the paranormal, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And I, of course, didn't know that as a kid.
No.
I was just looking at Kirby's art. But you read it as an adult and the UFOs and parapsychology and
all there.
Kabbalah. And I mean, it is so in your face and everywhere. And you're like, okay, this is what was going on. And it wasn't that he actually knew a lot about any of this. I don't think he did actually. And this is the thing you learn.
He would admit that he didn't.
You learn this as an intellectual. You're like, oh, they're just picking this stuff up. And the other thing, it wasn't just the war, the World War II you're talking about. It was actually, it was also the counterculture.
Yes.
And it was, yes, it was psychedelics, by the way.
Dude, 100%. And
maybe, I don't know about Steve Ditko, probably not, but I guarantee you those later artists and authors of Doctor Strange were doing stuff.
100%.
And there is just no question in my mind about that. And the story I always tell here is I have this album, the CD of the number one hits of the Beatles. And the early stuff, it is so banal and stupid. It's like, I love you, yeah. I love you. All they say is I love you through the whole song. And this is a number one hit? Well, by the time you get to about 65 or 60, suddenly these number one hits just completely turn around. And they're like singing about yellow submarines and funerals where nobody's at and Lucy in the Sky. Diamonds. I'm like, what the fuck happened?
And
I'm
like,
oh, this is what happened.
Yep.
This
no, 100%.
Exactly what happened. And
yeah,
I think that comes into the comics in a really interesting way. And I don't say that again. I don't say that as a criticism. I just think it's really, as a kid, we didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, as in, I didn't know that. I can't speak for the other kids, but. We would get up like on Saturday morning and we would eat outrageous amounts of sugar cereal, way more than is probably a proper. And then we would sit in front of the TV and just totally buzzed. And we were watching cartoons like H.R. Puff and stuff. And, you know, it never entered our minds that these guys were doing things, that they were smoking stuff. But if you watch those cartoons, they are...
Oh yeah,
they are wild.
Oh yeah,
they're just kind of crazy stuff. And so there was an impact that you picked up as a kid through the art, through the cartoons, through the comics. Yes. We were not. My generation was not part of that counterculture. We were too little, too young, too late. But wow, it had this incredible cultural impact.
You got the 70s response, which was some of my favorite. It created like some of my favorite art in the world, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Like, I think I've heard you talk briefly about the 70s just being a weird time in general.
It was wild. Yeah.
And yeah, I would love to touch on that. But before, one of the things you just made me think of when you said that about the Beatles that I think is completely apt to the comics world too, it was this American cultural export of rock and roll that was digested by this other culture and then reprocessed and brought back over, which inspired the garage bands and really took off to psychedelics. And like that's where that psychedelic really got twisted up, is when it combined with this boom in the suburbs where you could afford a guitar as a, you know, middle class kid, and you could start your own band, and then you could find somebody that might have a little marijuana cigarette that you could smoke. So like the Beatles took this thing that was American and, you know, translated it and brought it back here and reintroduced it and like kind of subverted it a little bit with those things and made it. And the same thing happened to comics. Like if you look at comics, when the real, I think my favorite part of when comics get really weird is what they call the British invasion of comics, with your Morrisons and your Moores and, you know, all these guys that are coming from across the seas. And looking at this, there's a guy, a comic artist, Tom Scioli, that I really love. He wrote a biography on Jack Kirby and Stan Lee recently. They're both beautiful graphic novels about the two. And he has this theory that he loves to talk about how, essentially, in comics in America, before the Brits really got involved in it, it was all science gone wrong and mutants and these things that were very monster-based. But then you get Alan Moore and these guys introducing magic and esoteric thought and, you know, these different types of more heady ideas that changed the whole genre in good and bad ways. Like, you know, there's definitely some things that have stuck around that probably should go away at this point, and some things that, like, you know, have, like, I've always been more on the Morrison side, where, like, his rap about how Alan Moore took the superheroes and brought them to our world, and that's kind of bullshit. Like, he always wanted to live in the world of the superhero. Like, why bring the superheroes to deal with our, like, boring problems when we could just go be superheroes for a couple hours? And I always kind of clicked with that a little bit more. But yeah, that's interesting to me how cultural exports and then kind of reintroducing to the culture it came from has these giant effects and shifts on the medium itself.
Yeah, and the stuff I had worked on before Mutants and Mystics was, again, the human potential movement or the counterculture, and psychedelics was hugely impactful in both a positive and a negative way. I don't want to romanticize those molecules or that period, but what the psychedelics did early on was give ordinary people access to states that only the mystics and the saints had. Yeah. And it gave people immediate access. I mean, and sometimes unwilling access. I mean, they would have these experiences at a party or in a casual environment, you know, where there was no control or no ritual involved. And sometimes there was, but my point is that in the 50s and the early 60s, you have intellectuals like Aldous Huxley and Houston Smith and Tim Leary. I mean, these are all basically either professors or professional writers who grew up in intellectual families, and they're ingesting these psychoactive molecules and they're having religious states. Mm-hmm. And they're interpreting these states in ways that are sometimes not classically religious. But the, you know, something that Houston Smith often said was, look, I spent my whole life meditating and trying to have one of these experiences. And then there's Tim Leary and he hands me, and it's just boom, you know, I mean, just kaboom.
Yep.
And
yep.
That's really significant. Mm-hmm. That's super significant, I think, to creativity. And what most people don't know, and I'm not a psychedelic person, Todd, I'm not speaking from experience here, but what most people don't know about psychedelics who aren't in that culture is that it's filled with paranormality. I mean, it's just chock full of telepathy and precognition and clairvoyance and entities and you name it. And so all this stuff feeds into, I think, this creative soup that the comics and the science fiction were just kind of swimming or messing around in the 70s and 80s or 60s and 70s for sure.
Absolutely. It seems, I mean, it makes me think of one of McKenna's raps where that's why he fell in love with the mushroom, because he went and studied in India and no one could give him anything physical. He couldn't have that physical experience. And then he goes to Mexico and they're like, oh, here you go. And it was like that. He's like, this is something I can take, I can hold, I can bring back, I can, you know, experiment with, et cetera. And that made a lot of sense with my own experiences as well. It gives you that, like, and maybe that is, he was always very upfront of saying that might be a Western, that Westerners have to have that material access to that or something along those lines. And
I don't think it's just Westerners. I lived in India and sadhus or holy people, they're smoking stuff. Yeah. I mean, come on. I mean,
no, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense.
And a lot of the indigenous cultures of the Americas, you know, they were persecuted and suppressed by conquistadors and missionaries precisely for their use of their ritual and religious use of psychoactive plants. And so the link between religion and ecstatic states and psychoactive plants is an ancient one, Todd. And I don't think it's just a bunch of hopeless Western people needing no. something more stronger. I actually think it's like a global, I mean, you held up earlier a book by Brian Murescu, and mm-hmm. you know, his basic argument, or one of his arguments, is that no, this is kind of at the core of Western civilization. It's clearly in Greek culture, and it gets suppressed, yes, but it's very much a part of the history of religions as well, including in the West, including in Europe.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, and I think you're absolutely right. I think I was going at that more our cultural lens affects the way that we kind of ingest ideas. And I always liked that he was very upfront with his culture is the enemy. That whole rap was always very meaningful to me, and something that I don't think, one of the things that I eventually wanted to get to with you that I think Terrence is a great bridge to is how the imagination is kind of undervalued in society and in general, how there's something to the connection to your newest work in the superhumanities and these ideas that we are superhumans and the imagination that people kind of undervalue in every regard of life these days. I feel it a lot, and especially kind of my kids are entering the school system for the first time, and there's a lot of imaginal undervaluing I found. And my kid has aphasia. He has the neurological speech issue, so he's a little behind and kind of hard to understand, and it's been really interesting to see the way that impacts his consciousness forming, if that makes sense. Like, it's really interesting to see the way that he interacts with not only the world, but his thoughts and the way he expresses himself as he can use more words and form sounds differently. But I kind of wanted to talk to you about the imagination and where it stands in culture these days.
Not well.
I was hoping for something more positive, Jeff.
Let me say a couple things that are different things. One is that, we don't understand one another because we literalize the imagination. So the first thing, the imagination can act as a powerful unifier of people across the globe and across cultures. And let me put it this way. If 12 people have a near-death experience, in Asia and Europe and the Americas, they're all going to have different experiences. They're all going to be culturally conditioned and constructed. And yet they're all having an experience. They're all having this near-death experience. And so it's really the imagination. Because we lack a theory of the imagination, we don't have a way to put those things together. And so we will say things like, Hindus are Hindus and Christians are Christians and Muslims are Muslims and, Jews are Jews and they'll never meet. Well, they do actually. But we don't talk about the imagination in a way that unifies the species. And I think the other thing that I'll say is we also think about the imagination in reductive terms. It's just imaginary.
Yeah.
We don't have a model of the imagination that sees it as a mediator. We only have a model of the imagination that sees it as a spinner of fantasy. Let me put it that way.
That's beautiful.
And
sad, but beautiful.
And I'll give you an example. Maybe you've heard this story. Again, I only have 5 stories you've heard. You probably heard 6 of them, so you're probably bored.
I've gotten a couple new ones out of you so far, So.
Did you hear the story about the weirdest thing that ever happened to you and the theory of the imagination? Have you heard that one?
Maybe. Go ahead. Maybe. Let me hear it.
Well, so I invited all these people to come to this conference, and I said, look, tell me the weirdest thing that ever happened to you, and then give me a model of the imagination to explain it. Well, they all had a drop your jaw, weird experience, but none of them had a theory. And I kind of think that's where we are as a culture, is we don't have a way. And, paranormal, the word paranormal actually is very useful because it combines a lot of things that are otherwise we wouldn't necessarily combine, but it's not real. We don't really theorize it. We don't kind of push it into a model of what's happening. And I think when we think about the imagination, I think we need to really push it very, very far. And by that, I mean, people see entities, people levitate, people see craft in the sky. Lots of people do. So do dogs and cats, by the way. So what is going on there? Clearly that is not a hallucination, but also it obviously is culturally conditioned in some way. And I think those are the two things we don't really have a way of thinking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. I man, there's so many things there that I'd love to talk to you about too. And I probably have lost several threads in which I might try and randomly tie up before we end our time here. But it really makes me think of, I'm real lucky. I'm a full-time artist. I get to sit at a drawing table essentially for, you know, 8 hours a day. I get a lot of time to listen to people like yourself talk, read book, listen to books, you know, do a lot of stuff in which like I get to spend time realizing how real the imagination is, right? And I think about how hard that is for some folks that don't have that amount of time, and how there's no, because like you were saying, there's no model or definition of it. It's something everybody kind of has to find for themselves. And there's something to the paranormal that seems to be useful. Like there's something to these stories of real strangeness. And what you were just talking about made me think about, I had Dr. Jack Hunter on here a little bit ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about his idea of the boggle threshold and these cultural boggle thresholds, and how like each culture has its different, you know, it'll let this amount of strangeness in, but not this amount. And how can we stretch those thresholds? And I think things like comics and fiction seem to be like a good way to do it, or it seemed to be like the tools we have at hand right now, would you say? Or
Let me say something about that, because I think it's a very serious issue. So I've been reading the journals of Jacques Vallée recently, and there's this one scene in there where a friend of his says, "Look, I saw Uri Geller bend metal melted essentially in this man's hand. Why didn't that impact my life? I just forgot about it. You know, I just went on with life." And you see the same thing in the sport world, by the way, that, you know, an athlete will have some bizarre clairvoyant or precognitive experience on the playing field, and then he'll deny it actually the next day. And, or, you know, you'll talk to an encounter witness or an abductee, and they'll dismiss their experience and their own experience.
Yeah.
So I think there's something in us that resist too much strangeness. You know, this is Jack's point.
Yeah.
The boggle threshold, it's not just an intellectual thing. It's not just because, you know, we're not smart enough or we haven't read enough books or something. It's emotional, and it's also, this is going to sound like a real bummer, but I think we're being duped. I think we're somehow being tricked. And a lot of this stuff is profoundly deceptive in a way. And I think it's intentionally deceptive. People are deceiving people. There's a lot of hoaxes and fakery and all of that. But what people don't talk about is that the deceptive quality of the phenomena itself. Mm-hmm. And I really wonder about that, you know, and I think about that a lot. And, that's a really serious kind of thing, because it means, well, first of all, I don't trust any of this, by the way. I don't think you should trust it. But that doesn't mean it's not real. You know, this is where people go. They say, "Oh, that it's not real. It's fake." I'm like, "No, it's not fake, but it kind of is."
It's a whole other model. No, and I think you're right. I think it's a very serious part of this whole discussion that doesn't get brought up nearly enough. And honestly, one of the cool things is that it's starting to get brought up more. Like you're starting to hear people like Hansen referenced, and you're starting to hear, and on bigger pod, it used to be there was this very small set of podcasts that would talk about writers like yourself or George P. Hansen and these, you know, people that think very deeply about these things. Those names, yourself included, are popping up on bigger and bigger paranormal podcasts. Like they're getting to the point where these ideas in a small sect of the weirdo community are growing somewhat, but it doesn't mean they're still being taken seriously or, you know, kind of expanded upon correctly or any of those things. But one of the things that I think is always attracted me, or I've always found interested, is exactly what you just said, how this stuff loves to live in that like untrusted space, that like it's more people, McKenna himself included, is one of my favorite examples. He'd be like, he'd say something about seeing entities or aliens, and people would be like, well, you were loaded. He'd be like, yo, you're damn right I was loaded. Like, how else are you going to do this? Like, that's what you'd do. Or Grant Morrison's one of my other favorite examples in his DisinfoCon talk that he gave. He starts the whole thing with saying, I got abducted by aliens in Kathmandu because I went to Kathmandu to get abducted by aliens. And he, you know, proceeds to tell this beautiful story that I would love to talk to you about at some point, actually, and maybe we'll do that in a second. But at the end of the day, I think you're right. I think there's this something about this stuff that loves to hide in this weird kind of like, shady side of things.
I'm a teacher, and I say that because some people can hear things and other people can't. And I don't mean that in a dismissive or a mean way. I mean, a lot of this stuff, it's not like some kind of truth I could whisper to you and then you know the truth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think particularly in the US, we operate with a kind of egalitarianism. We think everyone's capable of everything, but actually they're not. That's actually not true. And when you come to knowledge, or you come to these forms of knowledge, it's obviously not true. And, you know, someone like, to go back to Jacques Vallée for a minute, what I find so interesting about him is he really believes that there's a there, but that actually nobody knows what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, that's very convincing. And so when people are certain about anything, I'm just like, well, you're either an idiot or you're lying. I don't know what, but you can't be certain about this. Yes. And so that's really my criterion when I listen to people, is how certain are they about something, or how righteous do they sound? And if they sound certain or righteous, I'm like, probably not.
I'm really lucky that Robert Anton Wilson was a very big influence on me early on, as far as maintaining open minds and agnosticism, and not being married to different ideas in certain ways. Also, how I found out about Jacques Vallée was through his book Cosmic Trigger. And that was my first introduction to Jacques. And funny, like, people's gateways into these things seem to shape a lot of their experience with them. And, like, you know, it's always interested me what motivates people to stay where they're at when they're looking at these type of subjects, and what motivates people to kind of to hear them like you're talking about, and to kind of go to that next step.
But I think the thing I want to stress, which may not be obvious when I talk, is that I'm skeptical of the skepticism, and I want to deconstruct the deconstruction. And I want to, you know, just because something is culturally constructed doesn't mean there's not something coming through. And this is what I meant by the imagination as a mediator or a translator. Yeah, it's imagined. Yeah, Terence McKenna was on mushrooms or LSD. So what? You know,
exactly.
That doesn't mean that what was coming through that altered state wasn't actually so.
Yeah.
The same is true with near-death experiences, by the way. The same is true with mystical experiences. Of course, they're all filled with chemicals and hormones and God only knows what. But again, that does not mean that what is being perceived is not somehow so. But again, this is where we lack a theory of the imagination, Todd. I don't think we have one. You know, I wrote a book once with a woman who had a near-death experience, and she would say things like, well, everybody's going to have a different near-death experience. But she was adamant that there was an afterlife, or there was some kind of life force on the other side. But she was also adamant that whatever your experience of it is going to be conditioned by your culture and your background. And I guess that's what we lack. We don't. Mm-hmm. We lack that both and. We just keep falling into an either or. It's either all true, and I'm going to be an evangelical Christian or a Orthodox Jew or whatever I'm going to be now, or it's all baloney.
Yeah.
And those are not those are neither one of those statements is helpful mm-hmm. in this zone.
I completely.
And that's why I love comics. You take us back to this yeah. thing. That's why I love comics and fiction. Is these people know they're writing fiction.
Yeah.
They know this is made up. You know, but. Yep. They also, I think some of them at least know that something's coming through the fiction. And writers in particular, I mean, I've known a lot of writers in my life, and they will often say, like your artist friends or your musician friends, it's not me.
Yep. Not completely. Yeah. Yeah. So we're coming up on an hour here, and I want to be respectful of your time, and I don't want to take up too much more. But yeah, I think there's... Well, two things I wanted to touch on. One is to kind of go back to, because I think it ties into what you were just saying about the imagination and Grant Morrison's experience in Kathmandu when he has the message from the silver blobby entities that essentially tell him that the earth and our experience here is essentially an idea farm, that they can't grow ideas outside of space and time. And because of the way that we interact linearly with time, they come here to, essentially grow these ideas and stories. And that's his job, is to go back. And he explains how that is very similar to ideas that like William Burroughs and Geisen had, and all these other mystical thinkers, where they're from psychedelics to other type of experiences, where there's been this communication that we are kind of like a giant art project here. And I always kind of love Greg Bishop says a similar thing, that the paranormal is like the universe's art project. And I love these ideas, and kind of wanted to get your thought on that type of thing as well.
Well, first of all, I teach that very scene. I know what he's written about it anyway in Super Gods, and I teach that. So that's this idea that we're essentially caught in an artwork. Yeah. Is very attractive to me, but it's attractive to me because of, again, the history of religions and the history of Western philosophy, which is essentially saying the same thing, you know, in much more, I guess, boring terms. But I mean, that's since Plato's cave, you know, fourth, fifth century BCE. I mean, that's essentially a movie theater, Todd. Yeah. I mean, and the idea has been since then that what people are perceiving as reality with their senses and with their rationality is actually not what's there. And you see that played out over and over and over again in different contexts, of course. You don't need Plato to say that, or you don't need Grant Morrison to say that. But maybe you do need Grant Morrison today. You know, maybe you do. I don't know. Have you read... drawn a blank now on his name, but he wrote a book. He's a neuroscientist, Don Hoffman.
Okay.
Wrote a book on neuroscience, and he basically makes the same argument that basically what the senses are seeing, you know, it's not what's actually there. We've evolved to survive. We haven't evolved to perceive reality as it is.
Yeah.
And to me, that's very plausible, but it's because of this deeper history. It's not because of what neuroscience is telling us or what comic books are telling us, So I put everything in a larger perspective, and I hear what I hear and I see what I see because of this sort of background history, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So all the comparative religion that you've been doing is influencing the way that you're hearing Grant Moore. It's like you said earlier, you can see these people are grasping at the right ideas and coming to their own conclusion. Well, Grant Morrison's obviously read a lot and everything, but like you can see that they're coming to the same conclusions that the comparative religions that you've been working in have come to for years.
Yeah. You know, in this book, in The Mutants in the Sixth Book, there's a chapter called The X-Men Before Their Time.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, it goes as far back as you want. I mean, it turns out this is like the oldest idea in the book that, human beings have these abilities, and this is religion. I mean, religion has been defined as legitimate science fiction. And I think that's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I think that is correct. And so I think this modern stuff with this fiction that we call science fiction or that we call fantasy is it has these deeper religious impulses to it that people don't always want to hear, because they associate religion with, again, what basically messed them up. I'm just like, yeah, I know. That's your
tradition. Words are tough.
Please don't worry about that. Don't conflate what I'm saying with your bad experiences.
Yeah.
Because all these experiences are bad. I mean, and same with the comics. I mean, come on. I mean, you can't live in these comics are messed up. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, it's all messed up. But that's the nature of being a human being, I guess.
It is. There, Doug Rushkoff, one of my favorite lines that he says is the magic of the humans is in the squishiness. It's in the weird, squishy parts. And that's why things like, we don't have to worry about things like AI or anything because they suck at being squishy. They'll never get a David Lynch film. They'll never understand how to enjoy and I think that's so spot on. That's why we're special, like that squishy weirdness. I don't know. I love it.
Yeah, I just, again, going back to these journals, I mean, there's this wonderful passage where this French writer named Aimé Michel, he says, you know, using science to study the UFO, it's like taking the Cathedral of Notre Dame and crushing it into dust and then studying the dust and saying, oh, it's made out of stone. I was like, yeah, I suppose that tells you something, but that is actually not what the Cathedral of Notre Dame is all about. Yeah.
That's so wonderful. That's a great way to kind of transition to what I want to end with here, since we're almost at the hour here. I've been fascinated by the Archives of the Impossible, and I've watched most of the stuff you all put up online and everything. And one of the things I love about how you talk in regards to the paranormal and the people kind of defining the future of it is you call for all of these different people to be involved, including artists. And I think that's something I don't hear very often. Like I was saying, in a lot of the paranormal circles, you're starting to hear the comparison to psychedelics and religion and things a little bit more often. People still aren't making that creative. Like, I don't hear people going that next step to it, tying it to the arts and the creativity. And I would kind of love to hear you talk a little bit about the Archives of the Impossible and what it's like bringing scientists and creatives and academics and non-academic authors and all these people together around this topic of the impossible.
Yeah. So the Archives of the Impossible is an actual archive. We have 15 collections, about well over 1 million documents now. And it's very much a collection of anomalous phenomena. So there's a really heavy UFO base to it, but it also reaches out into remote viewing and spiritualism and mediumship and Fate magazine and all kinds of things. And I've held now two of these conferences to try to organize not just academics, but also experiencers around these topics and create a kind of community. And that's really what I think the conferences are about. It's about creating some kind of global conversation and community around this that's rooted, I'm an academic, Todd. I'm not a podcaster. I'm not an artist. So I'm going to work where I work and I'm going to be what I am. And the thing about universities is anthropologists and sociologists and historians and philosophers, they're like really interested in this stuff, but they think that no one else is, and they don't want to step out on stage and have tomatoes thrown at them. So they don't say anything. And so, here comes this weird professor of religion saying, hey, let's talk about this. Let's put that on stage. And, I can get people to sort of, I can kind of push them on the stage and say, come on, talk about it. And it's actually really powerful. And we had just overwhelming response to these events, just overwhelming. Like, it just shattered all of our IT records. And it was just like these incredible kind of reception histories that have been overwhelming. So I think the interest is really there. And I think it's really important that the archives are physical and that they're at a research university and that it's multi-generational. I know I've said that a lot, but I really believe that this cannot be about Jeff or Todd or anybody else. This has to be about a an inquiry that goes on generation after generation, because we're not going to figure it out.
No.
You know?
No.
But you know what? If it's many, many generations, we'll figure out a few things, you mm-hmm. know?
No, absolutely. I love that it's a physical archive, too. I've only ever been to one academic archive, which is the Billy Ireland Comic Archive in Ohio. And it feels so cool to put on the white gloves and go through. And, like, I mean, there is something magical about holding an original piece of comic art that goes way beyond just looking at the craftsmanship. Like, when you hold a piece of art that Jack Kirby touched, you feel Jack Kirby. You feel, and I'm sure it's the same thing with you, with what you're collecting.
Some of our donors, so I'll say two things. Some of our donors have what I would call a psychometric view of the archives. And by that, I mean what you're talking about. When you touch a letter, there's something about the physicality of it and the actual touching. You sort of, the transmission happens in a kind of physical way. The other thing I'll say is, the people who love these archives the most probably are filmmakers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I just get so many inquiries. And I mean, like, big, big filmmakers who are, like, really interested in this. And I do a lot of work. I do a lot of work with lawyers, and I do a lot of work with our media office and Hollywood film companies. And you know, you're going to start seeing the archives a lot more in film and in documentaries, because they're coming here and they're spending days, you know, filming with this. So,
I think
the reason they love it is, again, it's this serious research inquiry into the phenomenon. It's not. Yeah. It's not a one-off. It's not a podcast.
No, absolutely.
It's not a weird religion professor to bring it back on myself. It's like, oh my God, this is like serious. And so that's really the Archives of the Impossible. And it's named after the authors of the Impossible book, by the way.
That's awesome.
Because it really comes out of this idea that there's something about story. There's something about paranormality and creativity that's really, really important here. And artists have come out of the woodwork, including musicians, by the way. I mean, they write me and they're like, hey, I read your books. You want to come to a concert?
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, I mean, it's like, and they send me songs and all kinds of stuff. And I'm just like, wow, you know, I mean, people are like doing things with this, and I'm just happy about that. Or somebody will send me like a screenshot of a Netflix series with actually Mutants and Mystics back of it. I'm like, oh, that's cool.
Yep.
They're actually reading it, or they say they are, in the thing. Maybe they're not, maybe it's just a prop. I don't know. I like that. I think it's a way that the broader culture can be shaped in some way by this.
Totally. Two things. I don't want to keep you too much longer. I know we're over the hour mark now, but one, I've thought about you because you're like, you know, you've heard people use the term like comedian, or like, and you're kind of like a weirdo's weirdo. Like, you're behind all of these, like, you know, I probably knew about Eric Wargo and Eric Davis before I knew about your work. And then I was like, oh, this makes so much sense that you kind of, you know, were so closely associated with those folks. And like, I think it's such a important role to play. I think about this dude, Danny Fields, who worked for a record company and discovered like Iggy Pop and the Stooges and the Ramones and all these bands, that he's behind the scene of so much culture that no one would ever know. And those people, they're very important. And I think you're one of those people in this very specific realm. Yes, totally.
I try really hard, Todd. I just try to connect people. I think people need to know, because I don't think, I think the rarity of paranormal experiences is simply an illusion of people not talking about it. And if you talk about it and you make art out of it and music, and so I think those are all good things.
I agree.
So that's why I do it. And again, you just work from where you are. I mean, it's just like, you do what you can. It's like, I mean, my goal in life is, you know, the day I die, I want to have caused a lot of trouble. That's That's the goal. The more I can mess up things, the happier, the guy in the ground will be, I guess, or I somewhere else, wherever that guy is, or wherever that being is. I don't know.
I think we need more of that. I think there's a lacking in certain areas of that kind of wanting to shake things up in good ways, and ways that make people. There's something to, and it's in your writing, like it is in the way that you communicate. There's something, it's the same way I know it's a good comic when I want to stop reading halfway through and start drawing. And when I'm reading your books, I want to put them down and like send you a message, or like I want to ask you, you know what I mean? And that doesn't happen. There's something, I don't want to say enthusiasm, but there's something there that is communicated that's more ethereal than just the information.
And the other thing I'll say, and this is the positive thing, is so I'm not an anarchist. Like I met anarchists and I'm like, you're not really an anarchist. No. First of all, you have clothes on and you're speaking English. You are definitely not an anarchist.
No.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is, the culture has produced us, Todd. The culture produces your podcast. It publishes these books. There's something nurturing and creative about the culture that we are products of, is what I'm trying to say. I don't see myself, I don't see any of us as unique or islands. We are just like nodes or expressions of this culture that is trying to transcend itself. It's trying to like, come on, let's go. Yeah. And so there's something really positive. And I feel that in the university, I don't want to get political here, but everybody wants to send their kids to us.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what we're going to say to your kids, right? I mean, so it's like being at the center of the culture, but yet being on the margins at the same time in some way. And I like that. I definitely want the culture to support what we're doing, but I also don't want to be so aligned with the culture that I can't question it and call it to the table, as it were. But that itself is part of the culture, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's all different aspects of the way that it changes and shifts and grows and evolves. And this could be a whole other podcast probably, but have you noticed with what seems like cultural shifts happening faster, it having impacts on like the experiences people are having and things like that?
Again, I get asked that a lot. I think people are coming out more and talking about their experiences because there's less taboo around it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced we're having more experiences. I think we've always had a ton. I mean, I think we're swimming in an ocean of these things all the time, but that the illusion is that, oh, there's just this iceberg there that's floating. No, I actually, the iceberg is just a frozen chunk of the ocean. I mean, you're in the water, man. Come on.
Absolutely. Which I won't even go down this because I wanted to get to consciousness and stuff with you eventually, but we'll save that for maybe another conversation.
Yeah.
I'm super fascinated by dual aspect monism. Is that still your current model of things?
That's my best guess.
That's your best guess. So yeah.
That's a nerdy way of talking about things, but yeah, that's my best guess.
I just love that one of the things that happens for people that get into things like the paranormal or creativity more, it leads to these ideas of non-local consciousness and interconnection. Yeah. And I like that's the end point for a lot of folks with this stuff. And I think that's special.
Well, let's talk about that, Todd, but at another time.
Yes, totally. We're going to wrap up here. Is there anything you want to leave everybody with, or is there anything you'd like me to share for you?
Go read. Please read. It doesn't have to be me. Just read. Just read anything. I don't care what you do. Just read.
That's perfect to end it on. I love it. All right. Thank you so much, Jeff. I'll definitely be talking to you soon.
Okay.